and the beasts and the birds and the insects were drowned in an ocean of dreams without a sound, whose waves never mark, though they ever impress, the light sand which paves it. Consciousness. Percy Shelley. The sensitive plant. Perhaps we shall be transformed into sensitive plants, one and all. We can just kind of hang out together like the lettuce people. And maybe some even further evolved creature, resembling ancient man or woman, will talk to us. Perhaps we will talk to you as we carry on through Saturday night. 2 days now after Pearl Harbor, 1 day after almost of the loss of John Lennon on the 8th of December, 1980. Anyway, our conversation with Drs. Joseph Farrell and Scott DeHart will continue momentarily on Coast to Coast AM. Yeah, can you imagine it? It's like, I don't like those lettuce people. Why not, Zorg? They're annoying because they're so boring. Yes, but they're part of the planetary computer grid. Okay, we'll leave them alone. I mean, let me ask you something, doctors. This is a question from down under. Sue in Australia wants to know if the people who are running this, if there's anything to suggest that they've come to the realization that this is a beast that's out of control and it's kind of taken on a life of its own.
Oh boy, what a question. I think, John, that part of the answer that some of the transhumanists would give is yes. And that would be the group of them that look at all of these technologies and transformations and extrapolate a future scenario version of what's going to happen in the hell version. In other words, that all of this leads ultimately to a dissolution of our humanity, and that we lose our ability for compassion and love and the things that we experience now. So I would hesitate to say that all transhumanists think that, but there are some that do predict that all of this technological alchemy that they're engaged in and indulging is going to lead to something very, very bad. So at least some of them do.
I keep wondering why. What is it about the human being that causes this fixation on self-destruction primarily? And I mean, really, philosophically as well as practically speaking, when you make war on another country, you're really making war on yourself. You send your best people in there. You send your best equipment in there. I mean, the best of everything. And there's just, it's that lemmings rush to the sea thing that's, I mean, otherwise, what can you call it besides evil?
Well,
and people go, oh, there's that word again. You're a religious fanatic. It's like, well, just saying.
Well, this is an interesting thing that you mentioned, John, this is the whole idea of war, because there is an aspect of this whole transhumanist movement that Scott and I bumped into that has to deal directly with military applications of some of these things. For example, you have DARPA investigating why starfish can regrow limbs, and the reason they're interested in this is imagine being able to genetically engineer that capability into soldiers on the battlefield so they get wounds and they're able to repair themselves, or through the use of nanotechnology to do the same thing. They're investigating waterborne mammals, and you know, like whales and dolphins, and trying to figure out why they are able to sleep with half of their brain still awake, so that each half sleeps at a different time, and yet, you know, the animal itself never formally sleeps like we do, otherwise it would drown. And again, the idea is to create the super soldier. So yeah, that's an aspect of all of this that when you look at its potential military applications, again, you're talking about, you know, the Nazi Superman, the new Soviet man, the super soldier. So all of these things are playing into this movement.
I recall also among one of the studies that we pulled up regarding regenerative medicine as it relates to the U.S. Army, there was one research method which was using what they call the immortal cells from a newborn's foreskin.
Mm-hmm.
And the idea behind that was that these immortal cells could duplicate forever unless killed by some kind of an outside force. And these cells were found specifically in the circumcised foreskin of babies. And this was a study and a research being used by the United States Army. There are some very curious possibilities, and whether it be consequences or benefits, I guess is up to the person who's in need or doing the work. But it does raise an eyebrow, that's for sure.
It's very interesting. Well, now let me ask you this. Who is at the forefront? Or you mentioned the Illuminati earlier. I take it there are no national borders here, but I get the feeling it started in the English scene. We've quoted Wilde and now the Shelley. So, and then with the Minister of Parliament a few months ago, raising a big stink about these 150 some odd different creations, genetic creations, and a big furor to try and stop that. Haven't heard a peep out of them or any word of any, you know, updates on that story. So I'm just wondering, on the proverbial scale of 1 to 10, is there any way of knowing where we are on that scale?
Well, in terms of the transhumanist agenda, I think we're probably at least 7 or 8. In other words, I think we're almost on the cusp of a lot of these things becoming practical everyday realities. We're not quite there yet. And you asked another part of the question when you asked who's in the forefront of this. And this, John, is another aspect of the story that we really only brush over very lightly. But it's very, very clear, as you indicated in your asking, the way you asked the question, it's very clear that this has now become something that is global. In other words, it's already crossed national boundaries. It's no longer just DARPA doing this. It's private corporations, it's foundations, it's grants, it's universities. It's truly become an international phenomenon.
Perhaps it should be noted so that we're clear on the point. The transhumanist agenda that we're tracing historically, the relationship of the Illuminati to what we were writing about in Transhumanism and Grimoire had nothing to do with the influence of the Illuminati or whatever that appears to be today. The relationship was specifically to the influence of Weishaupt's ideals as picked up by Percy Shelley, who was not a member of the Illuminati, though he was very much an adherent to the same agenda, and even spoke about creating his own kind of subgroup that would be Illuminati-oriented of great authors and poets and artists who could affect the same thing. But that was the only relationship we made in transhumanism to the question of the Illuminati. It was tied specifically only to the time period with Percy Shelley and his influence in the background of writing Frankenstein.
All right. Well, you know, there's so much in this volume. It's what do we got here? Almost 300 pages, and it's there's obviously a lot of research in it, and I can pick anything in here, and we can talk for an hour on it because it's that there's that much depth. Let's go to Thomas Aquinas' final vision and alchemy. Now what's all that about?
Well, this...
And then again, this, Sir Donald Bruno.
This is something, John, again, that, you know, when we were digging into all of these alchemical symbols that seem to be recurring in this movement over and over again, we bumped into an alchemical text called the Aurora Consurgens. And it's well known to medievalists, but not so much to anybody else. This is a text in which Aquinas apparently had a vision in which the sexuality of God and the church, you know, God is usually considered in Christian symbolism to be the bridegroom and the church to be the bride. Well, in his vision, he gets everything so scrambled that the church or the individual human soul ends up being the bridegroom and God ends up being the bride. In other words, all the roles are reversed and scrambled, and ultimately you end up with the very clear implication in the text of androgyny. Now, the reason why the text is interesting is because Aquinas, after having written so much theological commentary, philosophical commentary, biblical commentary, I mean, the man was enormously influential culturally in our history. All of a sudden, he just simply quit writing altogether. And the usual explanation, John, is that he had had a vision, and being a humble and pious man, you know, he just couldn't write about it. Words failed him. But when you read this text, there are two medieval sources that attribute it very directly to Aquinas, and even go so far as to suggest that it may have been his long-lost commentary on the Old Testament book, the Song of Solomon. Well, the reason the other sources don't tie it to Aquinas is when you read this thing, it's very clear he's talking completely outside the pale of Christian orthodoxy, and he's talking about this androgynous fusion. So the text became very problematical, and Aquinas, in doing that, if indeed the text was, you know, his text to begin with, then very clearly he moved outside the pale of Christian orthodoxy altogether. He enunciated this kind of transhumanist androgyny symbol very, very clearly in this text.
Which would not be altogether that shocking, considering he is a link in the chain going back to Albertus Magnus, who had, the story goes, created his own homunculus, which annoyed St. Thomas so much that he destroyed it. So there is a curious passing of information, or at least links, and some very curious people who were both schoolmen of great theological renown, and at the same time, also men who were curious with science and questions of, for lack of a better word, trying to get to an original source of a person through alchemy or, changing the very nature of humanity without the aid of a woman or God.
So basically, everything that you've written here, it's effectively based on ancient texts.
Yes. Yeah.
Now, normally I would ask this question at the beginning of our conversation rather than toward the end of it, because the time is just speeding by. We've got a half an hour or so, maybe more, a little more. What led you to even get into this, particularly to this degree?
Oh, boy. It really began, John. We had for years, you know, we've known each other for almost half of our lives, and we, as students of theology back then, we kept bumping into these issues even back then and started discussing them. And we both read in ancient texts quite a bit and encountered all of these things. And what really brought us up short is when we started examining transhumanism, we just kind of looked at each other and said, well, you know, we've heard this before.
Right.
That's the way I remember it and kind of my own personal approach to it.
Yeah, I recall the conversation going back decades when we were discussing questions of theology, questions of science and ethics and human nature, and we would sit around together in the evenings, sometimes with my children, with keen ears listening in on the conversation, who continued to stay in the conversation, and who would ask the questions, well, how do you try to reconcile or make sense of what science is doing, what the religious faiths throughout the world would argue is moral or immoral? And who is actually dealing with the questions of this, who have a background in theology and an interest in the modern movements in science, and can see this in relationship to questions in the Middle Ages? So we pondered this for decades, long before we wrote this. And really just a few years ago, we decided it was time to put the thoughts out on paper rather than hold the conversation to ourselves.
All right, so if someone were to avail themselves of a copy of Transhumanism, a grimoire of alchemical agendas, what would you hope that they took away from it? I mean, is this something that is inevitable? Because clearly, I mean, the Illuminati, it's pretty much a foregone conclusion that it exists, it has existed, it does have influence. We know that I keep going back to the Nazis, and I'll tell you why. Because it seemed to be the refinement of that entire initiative. And earlier someone took exception to, I wasn't trying to make it sound like Hitler was a great guy. He was full of contradictions. He even wanted an alliance with England at one point. I never really fully understood why there was a mutual protection pact with England and Poland. And when Hitler went in there, then England declared war. But, you know, the facts are just, there's so much information. And the more information you get, the more contradictory some of it becomes. Mm-hmm. So, obviously, these guys were into everything, including, I mean, the first time that I ever heard, I mean, after Goliath, and I presume he was one of the giants, that entire book was devoted to, not in the King James Version, but... they seem to be the ones who, at least most visibly, were involved in things beyond this immediate realm, and their search for the way to design the super soldier. You know, I mean, these right. beginnings are really crude. It's like, well, let's just hook up the blonde-haired and blue-eyed ones, and we'll start with that. We'll isolate the pure Aryan blood, and blah blah blah. So, how far did they get? And I noticed you've written a lot of books that have to do with Nazi right. activities. Are they still around? Are they still a force?
Well, the bulk of my research has been to argue that, yes, they are still around, and yes, they are still a force. And as for their relationship to transhumanism, we might be able to say, to a certain extent, that Nazi Germany is the first real experiment on a social basis of trying to create a transhumanist society. In other words, a society where every aspect of the human being is engineered, controlled, managed, and so on and so forth. And they're looking for that ancient, pure type of human, the higher human being, and they're trying to get back to that. So in a certain sense, we could say that as a kind of a transhumanist experiment gone horribly, horribly wrong.
Well. All right. Well, when we come back, let's sounds like something that we need to get into, and I'm wondering if there's any way to impede its progress, if there's a way to not participate, or if we're just going to have to ride it out. We'll continue with our guest tonight. What a good time I am having. Again, I hope that you are too. This is pretty deep stuff. Doctors Joseph Farrell and Scott DeHart on the Saturday night edition of Coast to Coast AM. As I said earlier, normally the bona fides are discussed at the beginning of the program, but this is a little bit of a... Well, to me, this is really quite a nice little nugget, and it is this. These two gentlemen who are with us tonight, Drs. Joseph P. Farrell and Dr. Scott D. DeHart, they obtained... Dr. Farrell obtained his PhD in philosophy from the University of Oxford. His resume is filled with indications of study in fields like Nazi Germany, sacred literature, physics, finances, Giza pyramids, music theory. He's a renowned researcher. And Dr. DeHart, while studying at Wycliffe Hall, the University of Oxford, went on to spend the last 20 years as a writer, teacher, professor, and researcher with a wide range of interests in religion, philosophy, and 19th century English literature. So in other words, these ain't no hackers. And I'll tell you, over 2.5 hours has absolutely flown by. And when we come back, in just a moment. Let's find out if there's any way to get between the future that we may not want and the agenda of the transhumanists. This is Coast to Coast AM. We shall return. John B. Wells, delighted to be in with you tonight. Doctors, I realize that last little comment that I made is tantamount to making a gloriously eloquent statement and then throwing in an expletive for flavor and color right at the end of it. But studying where you did, you were really exposed to all sorts of, well, non-traditional, almost experimental thinking in regards to shaping and defining and altering the very human condition of thought and the perception of reality and its meaning. So in the end, are we inextricably linked to our future?
Oh boy, that's a great question, John. And in a certain sense, I think we are, but I think we have to understand or realize that we're not powerless before it, and particularly that we're not powerless before certain aspects of this transhumanist agenda. And what I have in mind when I say that is, out in California during the last election, they had a ballot initiative on the ballots out there called Proposition 37. And that was, of course, the proposition to label GMO foods. Now, it did go down to defeat. But the interesting thing, I think, about that whole episode is we have to understand how very similar it is to the fact that the tobacco companies decades ago fought tooth and nail to get any sort of labeling of the dangers of cigarettes put on cigarette packs, which eventually happened. And all that we're really asking is that GMO foods be labeled in the same way. Now, even though it went down to defeat, it's very interesting to note, and this is something that Scott and I have talked about when we wrote the book and that I've been blogging about on my website, and that is that there are several countries around the world which have either initiated partial or full bans on GMO foods. So it's not a helpless situation. I think, you know, in terms of combating some aspects of this agenda, we need things like Proposition 37, and we need not to give up on them if they go down to defeat. We need to realize that this is a campaign, not just a battle.
And I think, just to tag on to the first part of the question, along with Joseph's answer, is that having both spent a fair part of our educational history at Oxford, we're firm believers in trying to promote critical thinking. And so rather than supply answers for all of the questions that may be asked regarding something like transhumanism or religion or philosophy, we're much more interested in raising the question and trying to get people to look at the information out there, the history, the ideas, and to put something into the arena to bat around rather than simply accept what has been passed down, to handle it in an American educational sense of it must be A, B, C, or D answer, but rather to think beneath that level, which is why we chose to take our higher education outside of the country, where critical thinking is required in order to even enter into the program, let alone complete it. This is a frustration for both of us as educators, having spent a number of years, decades of our lives probably, in higher education, trying to promote the idea of cross-discipline learning, critical thinking, and then raising questions which will bring people to a higher level of understanding and at least dialogue, rather than what passes off as debate or engaging political topics, which avoid all of the topics altogether and become nothing more than very poor rhetoric.
Well, then, Well, clearly the GMO thing is a big part of the transhumanist technique of affecting the change, the actual change. But I just, I don't know. I don't know. It's frightening. I mean, how many things are we having to deal with now? Somebody told me the pronunciation was Nibiru. I'm supposed to roll an R on there, so can't really do it. So we got a phantom planet running around. We have these ridiculous, huge X-class flares coming from the sun. People keep clinging to global warming, and I think didn't Lord Monckton just get tossed out of the a meeting in Qatar when he declared the last 16 years there's been no global warming? So, I mean, how much stress? I know where I'm going. I'll get there. Stress, deliberately induced stress. That's what I wanted to get to earlier. Is this a component in furthering this agenda?
That's a good question, and I think to a certain extent it may be. It's not something that Scott or I addressed directly in the book, but one of the things that we did discuss was that this seems to be coming from so many different directions all at the same time. And I think that's part of why so many people feel overwhelmed by it. But I think, you know, again, to go back to the Proposition 37 thing and the GMO aspect of it, if you look at the way we laid out the book in terms of this alchemical four-phased descent and reascent, then you don't necessarily have to fight, you know, your little part of the battle in this on all four fronts at the same time. Pick one that interests you and follow that particular aspect of it, and do what you can to halt the advance of that agenda if you indeed think it's something that should be halted in your own life. For example, I try to avoid, if I can, eating any GMO food. I'm not necessarily successful at all of it because it's so much a part of our food supply. But if I do know of certain things that are part of this agenda, then I tend to avoid them. And everybody, if they would pick something that they can themselves do in their own lives, that's the start right there.
Well, isn't it the truth that? Go ahead. I'm sorry.
I was going to say, going back to one of your earlier questions, that very much leads into that same answer Joseph was giving, was what would we hope somebody that would pick up transhumanism, the book, and try and get from it? Joseph and I have, for the last 20-some-odd years, constantly been approached by people because of our background in theology or philosophy or our interest in science, and we are constantly besieged with people saying, well, you have studied this, you have come to this. And so when we came to a book like this, we had to approach it from the standpoint of how are people who have questions of their faith addressing this question of science? Because oftentimes within the churches, it isn't being addressed because it seems to be outside the pale of teaching in that particular faith. And then they come to us, or then they have questions of science and want to know, how does this relate to ancient civilizations, and where do you turn? What class and college do you enroll in? And so, having had so many different questions from several disciplines, whether it be literature or religion or science, trying to put together one cogent idea and allow the answers to come forward where people were asking but couldn't get a straight answer. That was really the point of the book, was to look at the general audience where he and I have had the discussions,
right,
where we have been asked but had never actually set forward some way of addressing it. And it was a rather complicated process determining the most simple way and coming up with a vocabulary that would make sense to address the questions of sexuality and gender, questions of ancient civilizations and their ideas of God. How does this relate to the studies of people in the Middle Ages who are meddling with changing human lives? And how does this relate to science today? it really took quite a bit of time figuring out a simple map work to lay it out and still touch all of those subjects and to make them connected. And we paced the floor for hours and raised our hands and said, it can't be done. We would have to write 3 or 4 volumes. And in the end, really the credit goes to Joseph for stopping me at the point of defeat, saying, I found the way to do this. We have to create a certain new vocabulary, and here's the way to go about it, where it will answer questions of faith and science and history that anybody who comes to it with no background or with a high degree of background can make connections that no other book on transhumanism would even approach. And so with all due respect and credit to Dr. Farrell, it really was a brilliant outline to approach a subject in a way that I don't think many people would have been able to approach, and we hope that will answer so many of the questions we've been receiving for decades.
Right.
So did Ludwig... Go ahead.
Well, alchemy is really the key. You know, it touches on history, as Scott said, and it touches on religion, and it touches on science. This is why we used alchemy kind of as a foil, because it was really the first enunciation way back when and throughout all of its texts of this transhumanist idea, this transhumanist agenda of transforming mankind and his consciousness through technological means and techniques. And that ultimately is how we think you have to view this movement. It's not something new. This is what we're trying to get across. It's actually a very, very old thing.
You have several quotes in your book by Ludwig Feuerbach, and this one, man is what he eats.
Mm-hmm.
A lot of people think that was Tiny Tim with the ukulele. And it says here, if therefore my work is negative, irreligious, atheistic, let it be remembered that atheism, at least in the sense of this work, is the secret of religion itself. Inevitably, I mean, I read Sir James George Frazer's Golden Bough years ago, where he submitted the proposition that man has two ways of dealing with his gods or God, and that is either through persuasion or with threats.
Mm-hmm.
So I'm just gathering up all the pieces so that I can ask this question, which is, everyone adopts, if you'll excuse the expression, the head trip of whomever they are around. So what does a depth in this type of research do to your heads, and do you feel that people can use the sort of information that you put into your books only if they adopt that head trip? And what is it? In other words, what frame of mind must you be in after studying this, and what frame of mind must people put themselves into in order to deal with this somewhat scary future?
Well, I can't speak for Scott. My own frame of mind, quite frankly, John, as we were researching this book and even writing it, was shock. You know, the futurist Alvin Toffler, years and years ago, wrote a book called Future Shock.
Isn't it amazing how much of that came to pass?
Exactly. And that's really the state of mind that initially I had when we first encountered some of the stuff that we were researching. And the second state of mind was being a bit overwhelmed. But finally, I suppose the third and final state of mind was a sense of calm, in this sense that so much of this is very old. We've been here before. We've seen this before. We've gone through these great cultural upheavals that have been brought about by technological transformations that have changed human culture. We need only think of the printing press during the Reformation. We need only think of the internal combustion engine toward the end of the Industrial Revolution and how that has transformed human culture. And we've come through it. What's different now is merely, I think, not only the quality of it, but the sheer quantity of it. So I come away with it, for my own part, with a sense of calm, and that somehow we're going to get through this.
I would ditto the last comments with that, and add that while it has the prospect of a very dark cloud on the horizon, I felt a sense of excitement and a small degree of perhaps liberation in that what we were doing was not just looking at a forecast of doom, but rather saying that there is something intrinsically beautiful, intelligent, and capable in us as we are. And what is necessary is to affirm that very instinct of what it means to be human, to look again at the world in its natural beauty, to approach the subjects of faith and poetry and fiction, and take these ideas that have been the very core of the human experience and fight to put them back into that register of human consciousness and say, this is who we are. This is our heritage. And great men before us have fought through this and made it. And there is a potential for human advancement that doesn't require changing what it means to be human. But we have begun to lose sense of that intellectually in our educational system. We've begun to lose that by detaching the very essence of humanity from where science moves. We've perhaps spent so much time in religion on commercialism that part of the advancement of human culture and civilization is lost in the name of pragmatics and perhaps capitalism. But what we can recover is the very core of what it means to be human, and that reaches us in our faith, whatever that may be. It reaches us in our quality of life and how we eat and how we live and how we express human relationship with speaking and writing, rather than having to jettison it for some promised future, which is very uncertain to begin with. So there was a sense of excitement and, I think, promise that the book goes to by reaffirming what human values we have, which we should not lose.
Very good. Very good. Gentlemen, we have to bail. I hate to do it, but I hope to speak with you again in the not-too-distant future, Doctors Joseph Farrell and Scott DeHart. Perhaps we're an extension. Perhaps we bring the judgment upon ourselves, or not.